Thank you, Brother Chairman, my dear brothers and sisters. Well, we come to the moment of truth today in the life of Jonathan. You'll remember if we turn back to the 20th chapter of the 1st of Samuel, and to the last verse of that chapter, we're told that Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, for as much as we have sworn both of us in the name of Yahweh, saying, Yahweh be between me and thee, and between my seed and thy seed forever. And he arose and departed, and Jonathan went into the city." And you remember that we made the point that the record seems to indicate that before Jonathan went into the city, that he stood and he watched David, his friend, as his friend walked away. And we wonder what thoughts must have gone through Jonathan's mind as he saw David recede into the distance. And no doubt one of the things that Jonathan was thinking of as he stood and watched David recede until he was only a small dot upon the horizon was, well, what do I do now? Where do I go? What decisions do I now take? And our study this morning is very much the study of what exactly it was that Jonathan decided to do. We hope to be able to piece together out of the record what we believe to be Jonathan's thinking on the matter that led him to the final state of things that we've read together this morning from the 1st of Samuel chapter 31. If you come to the 1st of Samuel 23, our story really starts with the situation of David in this particular chapter as we read it from the 14th verse. We're told that David abode in the wilderness in strongholds and remained in a mountain in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul sought him every day, but God delivered him not into his hand. It says there in that verse that David abode in the wilderness in strongholds, and the phrase is better rendered mountain heights. He abode in the mountain heights. And we're told where he was. It says that he was in the wilderness of Ziph. And there's a little city in this particular part of the land known as the city of Ziph. And just to the south of it is the wilderness of Ziph. And just to the south of the wilderness is a large mountain that rises up from the floor below, from the ground floor below, with a commanding view of the whole territory round about. A mountain to the south of the city and of the wilderness of Ziph. And we believe that it was in this particular mountain that David was headquartered at this time, with a situation so high that he could see for miles around the movements of people, and he could thereby ascertain what was happening. And as a result of that, we're told in verse 15, and David saw that Saul was come out to seek his life. He could see, you see, from the mountaintops. He could see what was going on. You know, you can't help but read verse 15 and be impressed with a sense that this was a time of enormous danger and of enormous worry for David. It was a time of deep anxiety. One gets the sense, as one reads the record carefully here, that the morale of David was gradually slipping away. The circumstances of the time were really a little bit too difficult for this as yet young and immature man. And every day he had to somehow try and keep his men safely away from Saul. It was a difficult time from that point of view. They were playing cat and mouse in the mountains every day. And every day there was a need for David to try and evade the men and the spies of the army of Saul, as Saul's men circled constantly in that area in an endeavour to try and find David. Verse 14 says, and Saul sought him every day, but God delivered him not into his hand. But David didn't necessarily know that, and for David it was a time of heart-gripping anxiety as he lived out each day for itself, playing cat and mouse in the mountains. And to make matters worse, we're told in this very chapter that he'd been betrayed by the inhabitants of Keilah, and Keilah was a city of Judah, and Judah was David's own tribe, and the tribe from whence he had sprung had in fact betrayed him in this very chapter. David's morale was slipping away. He was finding it very hard. And we're told that as a result of that, maybe there was contact between David and Jonathan during all this time. Maybe they had some way of sending messages to one another. Obviously, in some way, Jonathan must have sensed that there was a need that David had for strengthening at this particular time. And so we're told in the 16th verse, And Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went to David in the wood and strengthened his hand in God. You know, we need to read the record carefully, don't we? Good Bible study is all about good Bible. You'll be tired of that by the time I'm gone, but it's so true, isn't it? That's what it's all about. You see what it says there in verse 16? Jonathan, Saul's son, arose. You see, I believe that that takes us back to the previous episode that Jonathan's mentioned. In chapter 20, verse 42, which we've just looked at, you see the last phrase of that chapter says, here's the last time that Jonathan appears. It says that David arose and departed, and Jonathan went into the city. And from that moment on, we never hear of Jonathan again until this episode now in the 1st of Samuel 23 and verse 16. Jonathan went into the city, chapter 20. Chapter 23. And Jonathan arose and went to David. You know, I believe that what that's telling us, and by the way, not only that, but you know that this is the only occasion, this episode of the meeting in the woods, that apart from this mention of Jonathan's name, his name never appears between chapter 20 and chapter 31 when he's finally seen on Mount Gilboa. And I believe that we're being told in the record that for all those chapters, 20 to 30, and what was happening in those chapters? Saul was hunting David. I believe that that's telling us, the complete absence of Jonathan's name from those chapters is telling us that he would have no part of Saul's activities at that time. Jonathan completely disappears from the record. And while his father was out hunting David because of his obsession, I believe that Jonathan was at home. He would not have part of what was going on at that time. This is the only episode, verse 16 here, when it says Jonathan arose. And I believe that deliberately connects us with the previous, he went into the city, and the only time he went out of that city was this moment when he went into the wood to strengthen David. Apart from that, he'd have no part and parcel of his father's activities at this time. You know, the spirit of that is found in a New Testament passage in Luke chapter 23. Here's the spirit of Jonathan, isn't it, really? In the life of another disciple. Luke, chapter 23. He would have no part of his father's actions. Now in Luke 23, we're told in verse 50, and behold, there was a man named Joseph, a counselor, and he was a good man and a just. The same had not consented to the counsel and deed of them. You see the spirit of Joseph? When the Sanhedrin decided to bring together their power against the Lord Jesus Christ, Joseph would have nothing to do with that. He abstained. In fact, the word consented in verse 51 means to deposit one's vote in the urn. Joseph said, there is no way that I'm voting on anything to do with trying to track down the Lord Jesus Christ. He would have no part of it. That's the spirit of Jonathan, isn't it? You know, there's a lesson that emerges from that. You see, what else could Jonathan do? He couldn't stop his father. And I believe that the lesson of that fact, the very fact just that Jonathan's name disappears out of the record, the lesson is this. You know, there are times in life when we are powerless to do anything positive for the truth. Sometimes circumstances come upon us where we're not able to mould life as we would like to do so. And we find ourselves in a set of circumstances where we can't do much in the way of that which is positive for the truth. But there's one thing we can always do, and that is we can abstain from that which is wrong. And that's what Jonathan did. If you're not in a position to do much that's positive, you can at least stand aside from that which is wrong. Isn't that what he did? He said, I'm staying at home. I won't have any part of this. I do not believe it's right. He didn't have any great power to do much else. His father was still king. But at least he could step aside from that which was wrong. That's a principle, isn't it? Back to the 1st of Samuel 23. We're told in verse 16, and Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went to David into the wood and strengthened his hand in God. And I suppose perhaps the first amazing thing about this, as many people would have commented, is the fact that in verse 14 it says, Saul sought David every day but found him not. And yet in verse 16, when Jonathan wants to go to David, he went straight to him in the wood and found him immediately. Remarkable, isn't it? Saul couldn't find him. Jonathan found him just like that. Walked straight into the wood, and there he was. And no doubt there was perhaps a message that passed between these two men. Maybe they had managed to keep in contact. Certainly the spies that would be posted for David would know Jonathan, would recognize Jonathan. As Jonathan made his way into the wilderness of Ziph, the word would go through, Jonathan's coming, Jonathan's coming. And into the woods where David was, walked Jonathan, his dearest friend. And overriding all of that, whatever circumstances there might have been that allowed this meeting, the one thing that we do know, brothers and sisters, and it's particularly important for young people to remember, is that over and above all that, Yahweh allowed this meeting to take place. Sometimes we think that we've got to plan and to try and develop circumstances. God allowed this meeting to take place. Over and above whatever else might have been the case, David, Jonathan had always been with David in spirit, and I believe that both of these men needed this time together, and God allowed that. And into the wood went Jonathan and found David his friend. You see what he did when he got there? It says in verse 16, he went into the wood to David, and he strengthened his hand in God. He strengthened his hand in God. You know, it seems that David had little to contribute. Jonathan strengthened David's hand. It wasn't the other way around. There's no mention that David tried to encourage Jonathan. You see, it's all been Jonathan's role. In this whole friendship, Jonathan's the leader, isn't he? He's the older, wiser man of the two. And it's Jonathan that goes to strengthen David. David is the one in need of encouragement from his friend. And he goes into the wood. And he strengthens his friend in God. You know, you come to the Gospel of Luke chapter 22. Think about this. In Luke 22, we have another man who's a David, the beloved of God. And he's also experiencing distress and anguish as was David of old. And you know where he is in this chapter? He's in a wood. He's in the Garden of Gethsemane amongst the olive trees. And he's in a similar time of distress. And we're told in Luke 22 and verse 39, and he came out and went as he was wont to the Mount of Olives and into the wood of Gethsemane, and his disciples followed. And there's the Jonathan class, you see. But the trouble was, we're told in verse 45, that when he rose up from prayer and was come to his disciples, he found them sleeping for sorrow. And the disciples in the Lord's day never did fulfill the spirit of Jonathan, did they? They didn't really help Christ at all. They should have taken up the lesson from Jonathan's life, but the disciples on this occasion never did. And so God himself had to play the part that the disciples could not play or did not play on this occasion. And we're told of that part in verse 43. And there appeared an angel unto him from heaven. And look at these words. Strengthening him. And Jonathan went into the wood and strengthened his hand in God. Disciples never lived up to the spirit of Jonathan, did they? God himself had to intervene in the story of the Lord. And so really Jonathan here becomes a prototype of the angelic comforter himself, who provided that strengthening hand to Jesus in the time of his own distress as he lay prostrate in the wood of Gethsemane. Two Davids in two woods. And two comforters. It's a remarkable story. Come back to the 1 Samuel, chapter 23, and see what the record goes on to say. It says that he strengthened his hand in God, and he said unto him, Fear not. Fear not, for the hand of Saul my father shall not find thee, and thou shalt be king over Israel. He strengthened his hand in God, verse 16, and he said unto him, Fear not. Now, those two words are actually quite important. The two words, strengthen and fear not. Do those words bring a Bible echo at all, anywhere? It's Sorry? Yes, we're getting pretty close. Those are the two words used of Moses to Joshua. Be strong and fear not. They're the two words used of David to Solomon in the First of Chronicles. Be strong and fear not. They're the two words used of Hezekiah to the nation in the Second of Chronicles 32. Be strong and fear not. He strengthened him and said, don't fear. Those two words have been used in several different places where someone strengthened someone else and gave them encouragement in the truth. And so, what's all this about? It's one of the principles, again, of true friendship, isn't it? The principle of counsel. He went into the wood and he gave David good counsel. You know, we need that from friends, don't we? We all have a time when we need wise and helpful counsel from friends. Good advice that will buoy up our spirits and encourage us to walk aright in the truth. You see what Exodus 33 says? And Yahweh spake unto Moses face to face, as a man speaketh unto his friend. And there the two men met face to face in the woods, that counsel of the heart might be given, the one to the other. Proverbs 27. Oh, this is the spirit of Jonathan, isn't it? Verse 9. Ointment and perfume rejoice the heart. So doth the sweetness of a man's friend by the counsel of the soul. And isn't that what Jonathan gave to David on this occasion? The counsel of the soul. And sweet it was to the two of them in the wood. But there was also a need for David to be strengthened against adversity, to be braced for those things that were yet to come before him. Iron sharpeneth iron, so a man sharpeneth the counsel, the countenance rather, of his friend. And Jonathan was there not simply to pour healing balm on the woes of David, but also to give him resolution and strength of purpose to face the trials that Jonathan knew would yet lie in front of David. John 15 says, I have called you my friends, for all things that I've heard of my Father I have made known unto you. That's what friends do. They make known things to one another. And that's what Jonathan did here when he went into the wood and strengthened David's hand in God. Now look what he says in the 17th verse here. He says, fear not, for the hand of Saul my father shall not find thee, and thou shalt be king over Israel. You know what he did? He cleared himself before David of any guilt of being with Saul in searching for David. That's what he did, didn't he? The first thing he said to David, he said, I want you to know, David, that I've got no part and parcel of what's been going on here. The hand of Saul my father shall not find thee. And yet he cleared himself from any guilt in such a way that he never ever really did criticise his father, did he? You notice that? He didn't say, my father's got it all wrong. He said, the hand of my father will not find me. You see the tremendous skillfulness with which Jonathan said, he distances himself from what's going on, but he doesn't actually criticise his father or speak undutifully. To the very end, he honoured his father. That's an amazing principle in the life of this man, and given the circumstances of the moment. Do you know that in the Hebrew text there are three words emphasised? You know what the three words are? I'll just read the verse. Verse 17. Here's the three words emphasised in the text. And he said unto him, fear not, for the hand of Saul my father shall not find thee. And thou shalt be king over Israel. I shall be next unto thee. And Saul my father knows that. There's that triangle that Jonathan's been wrestling with for a long time now, isn't it? Jonathan, Saul, and David. And he obviously buoys up the spirit of David at this time when he says, thou shalt be king. He's absolutely confident, isn't he? You don't have to worry, David. I believe that you'll be king. And then he says, I shall be next unto thee, it says. I shall be next unto thee. The Septuagint translation, Green's Jerusalem Bible, Rotherham's, translated, I shall be to you for second. And what Jonathan is saying is he's assuring David of his undisputed right to the throne and the certainty of it. Thou shalt be king. And then he says, and I'll be with you. Now, when it says that I shall be to you for second, I don't believe that that means that he was going to be alongside David. He means that I will be to you the second in the sense that he would be behind David. He says, look, you will be king. There's no doubt about it. And he says, I'll be right behind you. I'll be second. Behind you. He gives David the priority of the kingship. That had always been the spirit of this man, wasn't it? If you come to the first of Samuel, and then he says at the end of that, and look at this. He says, and that also Saul my father knoweth. He says, my father knows that you're going to be king. Come and have a look at that in one chapter later. The first of Samuel 24. Look at this. The first of Samuel 24, verses 20 and 21. The end of that chapter. And this is Saul speaking. And now says Saul, behold, I know well that thou shalt surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in thine hand. Swear now therefore unto me by Yahweh that thou wilt not cut off my seed after me, and that thou wilt not destroy my name out of my father's house. Saul actually knew by this time that David would be king. Now, what spirit of madness drives a man, brothers and sisters, when he knows that David's going to be king, to then proceed to hunt him? Chapter 26, 27, 28, 29, 30. When he knows he's going to be king. What obsession eats a person out to that extent? That it's the spirit of jealousy. You know, there's an old saying that says, bitterness is the moorage charge on a harboured grudge. And that's what it was, wasn't it? Moorage, tying up a boat. Bitterness is the moorage charge on a harboured grudge. Brood on it for long enough. Allow the spirit of envy to work for long enough within you, and you'll be eaten out by it. And in the end, Saul lost his reason on this. He knew that David was going to be king, and he couldn't stop hunting him. Come back to the 1st of Samuel 23, and verse 17, Jonathan says, thou shalt be king, I shall be to you the second, and that also Saul my father knows. As the Jerusalem Bible says, Saul my father is himself aware of this. And so we're told in verse 18, and they two made a covenant before Yahweh. And so we come now to the third of the three covenants that these men have made. And remember, we've seen the other two in the 18th chapter and in the 20th chapter, and now we come to the third of the three great covenants that these three men have made. So you remember the first one in the 18th chapter. Their covenant was established on the basis of mutual reverence for God, and Jonathan acknowledged David's superior right to the throne by spontaneously giving him his royal garments and his princely weapons in sign of his submission and allegiance. And then that covenant of friendship made in the day of gladness was re-vowed and re-pledged between these two men in time of trial in the 20th chapter. And on this occasion, Jonathan acknowledged David's superior right to the throne by pleading for covenant mercy to be shown to both he and his house after God had established him as king. And now we come to the covenant in the woods. And their covenant is now sealed against their final separation by a mutual vow of undying love and of affection. And Jonathan acknowledges again David's superior right to the throne. And what does he do this time? By confidently declaring that David will be king, and by assigning to himself the humbler role of standing behind David as second in rank. It's really only one covenant, isn't it? But they made it three times. They delighted in renewing their vows of friendship. And this is the last time they'll ever make it, brothers and sisters. It's the last time they'll ever make covenant together. We're told in a number of codices, it says, they two made a covenant before Yahweh in the woods. In the wood. You notice the emphasis on the word wood here in this particular story. You see, it says in verse 15, David was in the wilderness of Ziph in a wood. Verse 16, Jonathan went to David in the wood. Verse 18, they two made a covenant before Yahweh in the wood. David abode in the wood. Verse 19, then came up the Ziphites to Saul and says, does not David hide himself with us in strongholds in the wood? Now the Hebrew word for wood here is koresh. And it means more, instead of what we would describe as a wood or a forest, it means more a thicket. It was a very dense gathering together of trees. In fact, Jesenius says that the word actually comes from a root that means primarily to entangle together. The word is translated in Ezekiel 31 verse 3 as the shadowing shroud. That's the word translated wood here. The shadowing shroud. This was a dense thicket of undergrowth, all matted and knotted together, where no light could penetrate in. And there, in the deepest recesses of the shadows of the wood, these two men met together. You know, it's almost as if a sense of foreboding and gloom hangs over the narrative. And they creep into the undergrowth, and there in the shadows of darkness they whisper their vows of love to one another. It's a very sad moment, this. A very sad moment. Because you see, Jonathan had said, thou shalt be king, and I shall be next unto thee. And they've made a covenant before God again in the woods. But you see, I believe that Jonathan knew that things weren't going to turn out quite like he'd said today. I believe, you see, that Jonathan had already now worked out what his course of action should be. And what I want to do is to take you through the record to show you what I feel anyway, and let every man be fully persuaded in his own mind, but to show you what I think Jonathan must have reasoned like and how he had come to his own conclusion as to the course of action he should follow. Now, if you come back, you've really got to come back to the 13th chapter. This is where it starts. You've got to trace through Jonathan's reasoning in this story. In the 1st of Samuel chapter 13 and verse 13, it all started with this. And Samuel said to Saul, thou hast done foolishly. Thou hast not kept the commandment of Yahweh thy God, which he commanded thee. For now would Yahweh have established thy kingdom upon Israel forever, but now thy kingdom shall not continue. You know, brothers and sisters, as we've said before, I believe that from that moment of time, Jonathan knew that he never ever would be king. He knew that. He understood that. But he didn't know who it would be until the 1st of Samuel chapter 18. And you'll remember that in the 1st of Samuel chapter 18, he had stood apart from slaying Goliath because he thought that the one should come who would be the king, and sure enough, that man did step forward and the giant was slain, and now Jonathan was introduced to the man who he believed to be king. And we know that from the 1st of Samuel 18 and verse 4 that, well, he says that Jonathan stripped himself, remember, of the royal robe that was upon him and gave it to David. And so now he knew who it was. He knew that David would be king. And do you know, brothers and sisters, if Saul had been prepared to relinquish the throne to David at that time, that Saul could have lived the rest of his life in peace and in happiness. And Jonathan. You see, God had said to Saul, I have rent the kingdom from thee. He didn't say he was going to take Saul's life. What he did say is that the kingdom will be taken from him. And if Saul had been prepared to give the kingdom to David, he could have lived. And so could all his family have lived, including Jonathan. And you know what? I believe that Saul came within a hair's breadth of giving the kingdom to David. The 1st of Samuel 19 and verse 24. This is another story. Oh, what a terrific... We haven't had time to look at this chapter, but that's an amazing story when David flees to Samuel in Ramah, in Naoth in Ramah. And we're told in the 24th verse of the 1st of Samuel 19, and Saul stripped off his clothes and prophesied before Samuel and lay down prostrate before him. Do you know that the word in verse 24, it says he stripped off his clothes, is the same word when Jonathan stripped off his royal robe. I believe that what Saul did was he actually took off his royal garments. And he was within a hair's breadth of giving the kingdom to David and said, here, you take it. It was that close. He almost did it. But the moment passed, and Saul decided not to. And as his obsessive hatred for David increased, there was a growing realization with Jonathan that for the house of David to rise, the house of Saul might have to be removed. And Jonathan knew that he was the chief heir of that house. Isn't that why when we come to the 20th chapter, that we have that sense of foreboding, that sense of sadness with Jonathan in the record? Remember the end of verse 13, Yahweh be with thee, 1 Samuel 20, verse 13, Yahweh be with thee as he used to be with my father. He knows that the house of Saul is finished. Isn't that why in verse 15 he pleads with David to not withdraw his kindness just in case I die? What made Jonathan think that he might die? And then he'd had the confrontation with his father. And he'd walked out, remember, blazing eyes, but he'd controlled himself, spun on his heel and walked out. And he'd sent David away. And the question was, what should he do now? Now that that argument had boiled to the surface. And he still had the same overriding concern as to how to resolve that terrible troika that faced him. How to be loyal to David, how to be loyal to God, how to be loyal to his father. You see, Jonathan always aimed at the loftiest of standards. The truth's all about striving for the best, remember. And Jonathan wanted to do the best for the truth. He wanted the highest of standards. He wanted the loftiest thing that he could do. That was always Jonathan's spirit. He wanted to satisfy all of those requirements. And on that basis, he made a decision. And you know what his decision was? He decided to stand with his father. And I believe he decided to stand with his father for four reasons. The first reason was the matter of his own example to the nation. If he left his father and joined David and fought against his own father, what example would that be to the nation of a son and a father who were king and prince in the land? How could he do that? How could he leave his father and then stand in opposition to him? He couldn't do that. There was the nation to think about. And the second reason was that he felt that he could actually do more for David's cause if he remained at his father's side, rather than if he joined David's band. Jonathan felt that if he could be with David, that if he could stay with his father, that he could actually do more to beneficially influence the course of events for his friend than if he actually went and joined his friend. And the third reason was that I believe that he never ever gave up hope of influencing his father for good. And the longer he stayed with his father, the longer Jonathan's chance was to change his father's mind. But if he left his father, he knew that that opportunity would forever go. And the last reason is that he believed that whatever his father's present state, Jonathan believed that he had been Yahweh's anointed. And Jonathan respected that. And for all of those reasons, I believe that he decided to stay with his father. And yet, as he made that decision, he made it with the conviction that if matters worsened, if matters grew worse, that he might actually perish with the house of Saul. And there were reasons to feel that his father's position was increasingly hopeless. He'd witnessed his father's mood. And you know what he had witnessed his father do? He'd witnessed his father then, after the 1 Samuel 20, he'd witnessed his father exterminating the whole of the priestly household. Slew the lot of them, except for one. I think Jonathan would be sickened by that crime. The whole flower of the priesthood was cut off in Saul's revenge because of his hatred for David. And I believe that Jonathan knew that that sort of action in the land could not go unpunished. He knew that. In fact, I think that Jonathan could see that the two houses were actually on a collision course. Come and have a look at the 2nd of Samuel, chapter 3. That's how the book of Samuel shows it. The 2nd of Samuel, chapter 3. You see how it's worded here? The 2nd of Samuel 3, verse 1. Now there was long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. But David waxed stronger and stronger, and the house of Saul waxed weaker and weaker. These two houses were against one another. And the very episodes the very thing that happened in these chapters proved that point, that Abner and Ishbosheth proved that the spirit of implacable hostility between these two houses would be there to the very end. The house of Saul stood against the house of David. And no doubt that was part of God's wisdom as a final measure of testing for David. But it proved the point, didn't it? That if these two houses were on a collision course, how could the chief heir of the house of Saul ever stand as advisor to the house of David? It couldn't be done, could it? How could the inheritor of the house of Saul ever stand as the advisor to the house of David? It would be confusion in Israel. It couldn't be done. And I think it was even more momentous than this. I think Jonathan realized that it wasn't just the house of Saul and the house of David. I think Jonathan saw something more substantial was changing here. You see, he remembered the promise of Genesis 49 that the scepter would belong to the house of Judah. This wasn't just a disagreement between two families. This was an impending change of the scepter from the tribe of Benjamin to the tribe of Judah. And I think Jonathan understood that. He knew that David was a man of Judah. And he knew that the house of Benjamin should never have had the royal right. And I believe that Jonathan understood that. And he also understood that if that momentous change was happening and the house of Judah was about to take over the scepter and the throne, that that was best achieved by a clean break. And so when he said to David in the woods, "I will be to you for second," I'm sure he wanted that. I'm sure that was his desire. But in his heart of hearts, he must have suspected that it may not be. That he stood related to an order of things that had to be removed. Now come back to the 1st of Samuel 23 and see now how a couple of statements in that record, when we appreciate the background of the story, how a couple of statements now absolutely leap out of the narrative with new significance and force. Now look at this. The 1st of Samuel 23, verse 16. And Jonathan, Saul's son, arose. You know, he hasn't been called Saul's son since chapter 19, verse 2. He's been called Jonathan ever since. And now, all of a sudden, as he goes into the woods, he's not called Jonathan, he's called Jonathan. He stood related to that house. And you see what it says at the end of verse 18? It says, "And David abode in the woods, but Jonathan went to his house." You know that in the Hebrew, the word for house is the word, of course, Beth. And it does justice to two things. It stands both for a house and also for the household, for the family. And what Jonathan was doing is he was making, the die was already cast. He knew where he was going. He was going back to the house of Saul. That's where he was going. And he knew it. And as he said goodbye to David in the woods, he knew that he was going back to stand with the house of Saul, he'd made his decision. The die was cast. You know, we're told in verse 19, it says, "Then came up the Ziphites to Saul to Gibeah, saying, Doth not David hide himself with us in strongholds in the wood?" Do you know that David wrote a psalm at that particular moment of time? At this very moment, after the incident of Jonathan with him in the woods, Psalm 54. So here's David's thinking at this very moment of time. Psalm 54. You see the historical heading to Psalm 54. A Maskil, a psalm of David. When the Ziphims came and said to Saul, "Doth not David hide himself with us?" Psalm 54, the historical heading. He's just met with David in the woods. Read what David says, verse 1. "Save me, O God, by thy name, and judge me by thy strength, and hear my prayer, O God, and give ear to the words of my mouth. For strangers are risen up against me, and oppressors seek after my soul. They've not set God before them. Behold, God is mine helper." And then he says, "Yahweh is with them that uphold my soul." Who'd upheld David's soul at this moment of time? That's Jonathan, isn't it? Who'd gone into the woods to strengthen his hands in God. "Yahweh is with them that uphold my soul." But you see what the psalm goes on to say, verse 5. "He shall reward evil unto mine enemies, cut them off in thy truth. I will freely sacrifice unto thee. I will praise thy name, O Yahweh, for it is good. For he hath delivered me out of all trouble. And mine eye hath seen his desire upon mine enemies," says David. And the tragedy of that psalm, brothers and sisters, and the one thing that Jonathan couldn't tell David in the wood was that because he was of the house of Saul, that he, Jonathan, in a sense, was one of David's enemies. And that his enemies would be cut off. And that Jonathan would fall in the day when the enemies of David were taken away. Do you know that shortly after this, David moved to Ziklag? Can we have a look at this in the 1st of Chronicles, chapter 12? David moved shortly after this to Ziklag. And we're told what happened when he got there. The 1st of Chronicles and chapter 12. Verse 1. "Now these are they that came to David to Ziklag while he yet kept himself close because of Saul the son of Kish." These are they that came to David. Who were they? Well, they were among the mighty men, helpers of the war. Now, delete the italics. "Armed with bows, and could use both the right hand and the left in stones and arrows out of a bow." And who were they? Saul's brethren of Benjamin. So to David there fell out those, at least in part, of Saul's own house that crossed over to David. So Jonathan could have had opportunity to go with them if he wanted to, couldn't he? There were those of Saul's household who transferred their allegiance to David. Did Jonathan go? No, he didn't. He was resolute. He'd worked out his conflict. He'd worked out how best to serve God, how best to honour his father, and how best to help his friend. And this is what his decision was, and mark these words. He had decided that he would cast his lot with his father's decline, and not with his friend's rise. That's what he decided. He decided to cast his lot with his father's decline and not with his friend's rise. That's the principle of Jonathan in this chapter, isn't it? Edersheim says about this episode in the woods. He says, Jonathan was fully aware of David's future destiny. More than that, he had sad presentiment of the fate of his own house. And yet, in full view of it all, he believingly submitted to the will of God and still lovingly clave to his friend. Far more fully and clearly than his father does he see into the future, alike as regards David and the house of Saul. But there is not a tinge of misunderstanding of David, not a shadow of suspicion, not a trace of jealousy, not a word of murmur or complaint, as we think of what it must have cost Jonathan to speak thus or again of the sad fate which was so soon to overtake him. There is a deep pathos about this brief interview, almost unequalled in Holy Scripture. And so it is, brothers and sisters, as we think of that moment of time when the covenant having been made between these two dear friends in the wood, it says that David abode, but Jonathan went to his house. Do you know what, brothers and sisters? They never ever did see each other again. That was the last time. And in only a short time after, the story of the 1st of Samuel 31 would occur, and the story of the Battle of Gilboa, which we took as our reading today. I want to just show you something about the story of the defeat of Saul on the mountains of Gilboa that I think is relevant to an understanding of this particular record. If you come to the 1st of Samuel chapter 28 and verse 4, we might just put a map up and see if we can work out what the story is on this occasion. I just want to see where exactly things stand with regard to the situation of the encampment of Israel and the encampment of the Philistines in this particular episode. We're told in the 1st of Samuel chapter 28 and verse 4, it says, "And the Philistines gathered themselves together and came and pitched in Shunem, and Saul gathered all Israel together and they pitched in Gilboa." So where's the Philistines encamped? They are encamped in Shunem, which is over here, nestling up under the hill of Moreh. See Shunem there? That's where the Philistines are encamped. And where is Israel encamped? We're told there in that verse, "And Saul gathered all Israel together, and they pitched in Gilboa." And here's Mount Gilboa here. This is the central range of the Judean hills, and it moves here into the last mountain of that area, which is Mount Gilboa. Here's the valley of the Jordan here. Here's the river running up. And here's the valley of the Jordan as it snakes its way up here into, broadening out into the plain of Esdraelon itself, with Mount Gilboa looking down into the valley. And across the valley on the other side, at Shunem, is where the Philistines are encamped, at the base of the hill of Moreh. In chapter 29, the 1st of Samuel 29 and verse 1, we're told that the Philistines gathered together all their armies to Aphek, and the Israelites pitched by a fountain which is in Jezreel. Now, if there was a fountain in the valley of Jezreel, it must have been near Mount Gilboa, because we know that Saul's on Gilboa, and yet it says that he pitches near a fountain in the valley of Jezreel. I believe that was the spring of Herod. It answers to the requirements of being a source of water hard by Mount Gilboa. We're told in the 11th verse of this chapter, "So David and his men rose up early to depart in the morning to return into the land of the Philistines, and the Philistines went up to Jezreel." So here they are now, they've moved across to Jezreel, and they're now spread out in the valley. The Philistines are in the valley, Saul is on Mount Gilboa, above the spring, the fountain in the valley of Jezreel, which I believe was the spring Herod. Now come back and have a look at the story of Gideon just for a moment and see where Gideon was. Judges 6 verse 33. How is the battle pitched in the days of Gideon? We're told in Judges 6 and verse 33, we're given the position of the enemy. Then all the Midianites and the Amalekites and the children of the east were gathered together and went over and pitched in the valley of Jezreel. So here's the Midianites and the Amalekites. They are pitching in the valley of Jezreel. They're spread out on the valley exactly where the Philistines were in the days of Saul. Where's Gideon? Chapter 7, verse 1. Then Jerubbaal, who was Gideon, and all the people that were with him, rose up early and pitched beside the well of Herod, so that the host of the Midianites were on the north side of them by the hill of Moreh. So Gideon comes to the well of Herod, and it says that the enemy is beside the hill of Moreh. That's exactly where the Philistines were when they encamped in Shunem, beneath the hill of Moreh. But he's not just encamped beside the spring, Jonathan, because we're told in this particular place, in this particular chapter, that not only does he encamp by the spring or the fountain, but it says that Gideon is on a mountain, verse 1. It says that Jerubbaal and all the people that were with him rose up and pitched beside the well of Herod, so that the host of the Midianites were not only on the north side of them, but as the 12th verse says, it says that the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the children of the east lay along in the valley. So the Midianites were down in the valley, but he was actually above, because we're told in verse 8, we're told that the host of Midian was beneath him in the valley. So if the host of Midian is beneath Gideon in the valley, and he's hard by the fountain of water known as the well of Herod, where's Gideon? He can only be in one place. He's on Mount Gilboa. And in that place, Israel won one of their most outstanding victories on the basis of faith. And I haven't got time to do this morning, but do you know who Saul's hero was? Saul's hero was Gideon. He modelled himself on Gideon. There is a substantive number of allusions in some of the records of Saul's exploits where he obviously, deliberately models himself on Gideon. And now the story of his hero comes back to haunt him at the time of the end, because he's on the exact mountain where his hero Gideon won a notable victory, and now it's Saul's turn. And we come to the 1st of Samuel, chapter 31, and we read the story then of the battle of Gilboa in the days of Saul, the king of Israel. You notice how the text tells us immediately what was going to happen. Now the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell down slain in Mount Gilboa. You see, it doesn't say that the Israelites fought against the Philistines. Oh no, it says the Philistines fought against the Israelites. It would appear that there's no spirit, you see, in the nation. The spirit of the nation has gone. The initiative is all with the Philistines. You read it again. The Philistines fought against Israel and the men of Israel fled. It was as if this battle was over before it even began. And I think there were three reasons why this battle went against Saul so swiftly and so decisively. And here were the reasons. The first reason was that Saul had gone to see someone the night before. Who was that? The witch of Endor. You know what the witch of Endor had said to him? The witch of Endor, in the discussion that had ensued while he was there, he'd been given this information that on the morrow thou shalt die and thy three sons. And when Saul crept back between the enemy lines, because he had to pass through enemy lines to go to Endor, when Saul crept back into his own tent that night, I believe he was a broken man. His spirit of despair would spread rapidly through the troops. The king was broken. He was a finished man, and he knew it. And here's the second reason why the battle went so quickly. Because you see, what had happened was the cream of the army had already defected to David at Ziklag, as we've seen in the 1st of Chronicles 12. Some of the best fighting men had already gone. So much so that guess what the word men is when it describes the men of Israel in verse 1? It's Enosh. There's no Ish in Israel any longer. There's no Gibor. There's no mighty men. There's only weak, ordinary, mortal men. That's all Saul's got left. And the third reason is that we're told in Deuteronomy chapter 20 in verses 1 to 4 that whenever Israel went into battle, they did something very special and very unusual. Do you know what happened? It's before the battle commenced, it says that the priests went out before them to encourage them in the battle. But Saul has slain all the priests. And there's only one priest left. And he's with David. There was no way, brothers and sisters and young people, there was no way that Saul could win this battle. And so we're told in verse 1, the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell down slain in Mount Gilboa. And then it says, and the Philistines followed hard upon Saul and upon his sons. And because he stood heads and shoulders above the people, maybe it was easy to pick Saul out. There he is, and the Philistines went charging off against Saul, and around him stood his sons as a bodyguard. As they retreated up the slopes of Gilboa, the Philistines were going uphill, and they still won that battle. And we're told in the second verse, and the Philistines slew Jonathan and Abinadab and Melchishua. And Jonathan was obviously part of the bodyguard protecting the king. So he died, you see, in a sense, so that his father might live. He was absolutely loyal to the end. And no doubt, brothers and sisters, as Jonathan died, his heart was 80 miles south with David in Ziklag. And that's why he really died, wasn't it? So that the cause of David might be advanced. It wouldn't have taken long. The last few breaths, the glazing of the eyes, a final shudder in the body, and a great man fell lifeless on the slopes of Gilboa, and he died as part of the house of Saul in the very act of protecting his father. You might come to the parallel record in the book of Chronicles just for a moment that tells us how Saul died. It's in the first of Chronicles chapter 10. And this is how the Chronicles record describes the same story. Verse 2, the Philistines followed hard after Saul and after his sons. And the Philistines slew Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchishua, the sons of Saul. And the battle went sore against Saul, and the archers hit him, and he was wounded of the archers. Then said Saul to his armor-bearer, draw thy sword and thrust me through, lest these uncircumcised come and abuse me. But his armor-bearer would not, for he was sore afraid. So Saul took a sword and fell upon it, and when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he likewise fell on the sword and died. So Saul died, now look at this, so Saul died and his three sons and all his house died together. It was, you see, exactly as Jonathan had feared, that for the house of David to rise, the house of Saul had to be removed. And Jonathan's spirit was, he must increase, I must decrease. And he lost his life in pursuit of that objective. That's a faithful man, brothers and sisters. That's a very faithful man that can uphold the principles of the truth to that degree in his life and be faithful to the end in the outworking of them. So what do we learn from the story of Jonathan today? Jonathan the selfless. The finest of friendships are nourished by the sweetness of counsel from the heart. True counsel is that which strengthens and braces and also consoles. Even when powerless to advance right, we can at least abstain from evil. And the disciple of the Beloved will practice that resolute choosing of the course which will best advance the truth, even to present loss and suffering. Jonathan beautifully manifested this spirit of self-denial by casting his lot with his father's decline and not with his friend's rise. He fell united with Saul in death. But it was David for the life to come. Farewell, dear Jonathan, until the kingdom.